Dean Bagent Mercer from Forest and Bird, based in Northland on the line from somewhere north of the Harbour Bridge, as in the Tamaki Makaurau Harbour Bridge. Kia ora, Dean. Welcome back to Nights.
Good evening. How's it going?
It's going fine. Now, you've been doing a bit of tramping, and you came across, and I, by the way, I want to let listeners know that if you've got access to the internet, there's some amazing photographs you took of what you came across, and that is some serious cyclone damage in the native forest you were tramping. Where were you tramping again, Dean?
Oh, it was Paparoa National Park. So a friend, Paul Murray and I, we went and camped over summer at the Punakaiki campground, and you just cross the road there and you walk up the side of the Purorari River. It's beautiful, striking, most amazing place with Nikko palms all over the show. We walked up there for an hour, and then suddenly things changed from this really beautiful forest into a bit of a hellscape, really. And I thought, there's been a major catastrophe here. What has happened? And we crossed a swing bridge, and there was carnage wherever we looked. And
what had happened? Had somebody been in there with a chainsaw?
Well, it did look like the logging of old on the West Coast, but it was actually the remnants of Cyclone Eta from 2014. And you could see these incredible ancient Tawhai beach and rimu trees that had just been snapped like they were toothpicks. Some of the beach had been shattered with the such sort of a force of the wind. There were like giant pieces of kindling 4 metres long. And so there are some of the photos that I sent to you that's now on the Forest and Bird Facebook page. Oh, sorry, the Radio New Zealand Facebook page. It was, sorry about that.
You wanted to join the merger, are you there, Dean?
I've got to keep on track. Yeah, and so now here we are 8 years later, and, you know, that was a devastating thing for the West Coast, and it affected a huge amount of forest up and down the coast. And underneath the shattered forest is this incredible explosive regeneration coming through, really vigorous of all sorts of different types of plants. And it's so wonderful because you can tell, if you know your native plants, you can tell the stuff that possums and deer and goats find completely yummy. And so that means there's really good control going on. And so it was just pushing through absolutely everywhere, through the crowns of dead trees. And there were seeds of things like kapuka germinating actually on the dead trees themselves. So you could see the forest eating itself. And so this is part of the Paparoa Great Walk now. So anyone can go there and see it for themselves. And it's just the most amazing educational thing to see this kind of change happening.
You know, Dean, that some advocates of the old-style selective logging of the West Coast might say, see, look, that's what a storm does. Say if we came through and took out a few trees, that's all we would be doing. And maybe if we use some of the money we make from the trees to fund pest control, we could keep the pests out. And hey, presto, the stuff responds.
Let's not fall down that trap again. That was mooted back in the 1990s, but to kill trees, to make money to save trees doesn't really make sense. And so there was a bill passed that allowed people to pull out some of the trees that were downed. Hardly any were taken, but you can tell when you go into those places that, you know, the soil needs the rotting trees to rot down to be able to feed the growing trees. So it's continuing the normal cycle. Nothing is wasted in the forest. It just goes round and round and round.
You wanted to talk about forest succincts. And now one thing before we get into that, is that forest there, a forest damaged by that kind of windfall, is that going to be a sink anymore, or is that going to be emitting carbon now?
Well, there's two things going on, isn't there? So the trees, as they rot, they are releasing carbon into the atmosphere. As the new trees grow really vigorously, they're sucking carbon into themselves and into the ground as well. So there's both of those things going on.
When it comes to sinks then, and you've been thinking a bit about this, and Forest and Bird has been thinking about a bit about this, is trying to clarify the rules, because it's still a little bit, even I have to say, I'm a bit unclear about where forests, native forests, pine forests sit in terms of carbon sinks, and also how we encourage them, if at all.
Yeah, it's a big spaghetti kind of an issue. And you might have heard over the past few weeks, particularly forest owners, whoever they are in the country, pushing back, saying they want pine plantations to be considered part of the ETS and for the government not to take them out. That's the emissions trading scheme. And a lot of it is like confusing and looks like you've got to choose between native forests or pine. And so we've been doing a lot of thinking about this and thinking, well, hang on, maybe there's another way that doesn't need to frame things in that way. Why don't we take a great big step back and look at what we really need to do, what's best for the climate and what's best for the different native habitats we have in this country, because you can win on both of those things. I mean, we are facing the twin crises of the collapse of forests and the ecology, the life in the forest, as well as climate heating. So we've been thinking, well, nature can help us cope with this, climate heating, but only if we protect nature first. So there are a lot of people, particularly, for example, Māori land forestry blocks, where way, way back in the hill country, there have been pines planted. And they're going to be very dangerous and difficult to get through, get to. And why not allow the opportunity for those places to return to native forest? And as the carbon is sunk into those forests, then the landowners get payments for it, as well as on farms. You know, if there's native habitats on lots of farms, sometimes you have some pines, you'll have a great big wetland, there might be some native bush. What would happen if the bush was fenced off and there was really good pest control happening? So that includes deer, goats, as well as possums. And so there's all this vigorous, as I mentioned before, vigorous regeneration happening underneath sinking carbon, and the wetlands are fenced off. And so that is also putting down layers of peat, and then the pines are doing their thing. And why can't someone with a managing that kind of land get payments in carbon credits for the carbon that is being sunk in those different ways?
So what are the rules at the moment, the rules that we're likely to have, Dean?
Oh, that's where it's up in the air at the moment, because the government has just done a submission round. They're in the space of working out what rules will be announced in the really near future. And so a lot of different interested parties have sent their opinions into the government to make sure there's the best outcome. And of course, everyone has their different angle that they're coming to this with. Sometimes it's income for corporations or for farms or for marae trusts, or it may be little conservation groups as well. So somehow there needs to be rules that satisfies as many of those different types of interests as possible and does the best for the climate and the best for wildlife and our native habitats as possible.
How do you go about doing that, Dean? I mean, let's go back to the example you mentioned before of what if you've got a whole lot of pines in the back blocks. You're a trust, Iwi Trust, you own lots of hard hill country land. You've got the pines out the back. It's going to be difficult to extract them. But how do you revert to pines? Once the pines are there, aren't they there for good? I mean, once they grow old, they might fall over, but it's going to take a while. And then there's wilding pines. I mean, keeping the pines and letting the natives take over once the pines are established is pretty difficult, isn't it?
Well, all of that depends also if there is native forest around and healthy and diverse native forests where there is a lot of birds, native birds, to be able to eat the seeds of those native trees and then fly up into the pines and then poo out the seeds so that the native forest can grow from beneath. And there are areas in this country, particularly along the eastern side, also the Manawatu, but, you know, east coast, Wairarapa, but particularly like Marlborough, South Canterbury and places like that, where there's nearly no native forest left. So if you do have old pines there or you plant pines, it's not going to turn into anything other than pines because there just isn't the seeds from the old native forest around. So in those situations, it might be possible to slowly kill those pines, and it can be they can be killed by ring barking them or drilling them and filling them with poison. And so, choosing which trees to die, there could be in areas where there's gullies and stuff. Those areas could be killed first for pines, and they could be planted in a huge diversity of native trees that used to be there that grow up to be the seed source, the seed bank that goes on to fill in underneath the rest of those pines. And so in 100 years' time, you do have a transition from gnarly old pines through to a really diverse native forest.
Okay. Well, that sounds plausible, but it also sounds labour-intensive. And where's the money going to come for that, and where's the return going to come for that, from that?
That's where we've been stuck for a long time, many years. What we're suggesting is that there's carbon credits that is paid to land managers or landowners for the carbon that is sunk, and then that money is used to employ people to do the difficult work that we've talked about. And there was a report out last week that talked about how using this kind of process on large areas of land actually will employ more people than what farming sheep or beef does on those marginal hill countries. So that's how the money go-round would work.
Right. Well, that's one thing. What about reverting, letting, if you've got a farm and you allow some of the harder country, maybe some of the gullies, maybe some of the steep slopes to go, maybe some of the swamps to go back to wetlands, the gullies to go into bush, some of the steeper slopes to go into bush? Well, that sounds plausible. But then there's this whole thing about significant natural areas, the SNAs. And maybe this is confusing things, but it's something that people think about, and that is the SNA is something, that designation that can be put on private land, and then the private landowner thinks, or at least the rhetoric goes, that they've got less control over their own land. And that's been a reason that a lot of people, including Māori landowners, have pushed back against SNAs, isn't it?
Yeah, there's been a lot of confusion and misinformation about significant natural areas. All it would mean, in the case of what you talked about, if there was a wetland on a farm, it means that it's acknowledged as a really important natural area. And with the carbon credits that I talked about before, there it means that it's registered in the regional plan of an area, so it's known about and registered, and so it's legitimate. It helps legitimise getting carbon credits, so it links both the Resource Management Act and the Emissions Trading Scheme or some sort of carbon credits scheme together. We're getting a little bit down the technical hole here.
It's very difficult not to, Dean, isn't it?
What was that?
It's difficult not to, though, isn't it, Dean?
Yeah, there's no simple kind of click your finger, happily ever after, simple solution. But it's up, ultimately, when you write submissions into the government and put your view forward, it's up to the government officials to sift through all of those different opinions and try them out and come up with the best thing possible that is the most workable. And so that's what we depend on those people for.
I was reading some of the coverage of the ongoing debate about this in Westland, and some of the rhetoric from some of the regional councillors was, look, there's enough significant natural areas in the Dock Estate. Why do we need to have any more on private land? And I'd swing that round in this direction to you, which is, well, what is it? What's in it for private landowners if they've got an SNA on their land?
Well, I have an SNA on my land. I'm really proud of it. I don't really understand what the big deal is. In this case, it would be the way to legitimise that you have a carbon sink. And if you're looking after it, then you would be able to get carbon credits for that. So, it's a way of tracking it. And it also means that councils all over the country have aerial photos of land. And so they can see if there's a significant natural area and whether it is there, if it's healthy, or whether it's been completely destroyed. And that's a really important thing because in a six-year period between, I think it was 2012 and 2018, over 28,000 hectares of native habitat got wiped out. And, you know, we get really concerned when things are happening in the Amazon or in Sumatra, all these places overseas, but we're still wiping out habitat here for farming and for other reasons. And so we really need to cherish those areas. And I know landowners would love to have a return on that land that they don't see as, you know, bringing money in. And so this is another way in a farm plan or a whenua plan to be able to bring money in.
I want to tie this back to something we talked about a few months back now, Dean, and that is the threat of pests, possums, browsing pests, deer, goats, pigs, whatever, on the forest and native forests, and the danger of canopy collapse, forest collapse. Now, if you want to make sure that your forest doesn't become an emitter of carbon because the ecosystem is so unhealthy because of the pests that it's not actually absorbing carbon anymore, then it's no good as a sink.
Mm.
And is the money you get from carbon credits going to be enough? We're going to need to spend more money, aren't we, just to make sure that the native forest we have is actually working as a sink, don't we? We can't, and that's going to have to come before we start getting money from carbon credits.
Well, I think the answer is twofold. One is, yes, we've got to step up again and make sure that native forests are healthy, and that's up to private landowners in this case to do that if they want carbon credits. If not, they're emitting carbon. And really, we want everyone on the same team. And so being able to get funding for that will help. The price of carbon credits for New Zealand has risen significantly in the past year, I think from $35 up to $80 a unit. And so as the prices rise globally, you'll be getting more and more income to help fund that pest control and look after that carbon sink. So that's one part of the answer. The other part is on public land, whether it's dock land or land that Lynn's looks after or the local council, they have to be doing their bit too and making sure the possums, deer, pigs and goats aren't escaping publicly owned land and coming into anyone else's land, scoffing their carbon sink and putting it at threat. So the responsibilities and benefits are all over the place, because councils and DOC and Māori Land Trust can also claim carbon credits.
Now, Dean, another thing, and this is something we haven't discussed, but there's been a fair bit of discussion in the media, particularly rural media, and that is the concern that people buy up land, hill country land on the whole, and they might be big corporates and they want to offset their carbon by planting a whole lot of pines. And you get these deserts of pines and there's nobody there, they're not being grown for anything. Now, how does your forest and bird policy address that issue?
Well, those people have kind of got ahead of the game, really, because they might have bought up the land and chucked pines in, but the rules haven't been established. So they've done it in a bit of a gold rush mentality. And so whatever the government announces in the next few weeks will be what the rules really are for those bits of land. It may be that they luck out completely. It may be that they have to front up with a really big bond and prove that they are going to move that area of pines into native forest over the next 80 years or so.
Because if the pines are harvested, then I assume the credits are gone. What happens when you chop them down for timber?
The timber is a carbon sink, but for a short time. So there's a different scheme for forestry, for pine forestry. I don't know all the bells and whistles about that. So that's ticking along in its own way. So this is about moving from pines to native or looking after native habitats that are on land. That's what I'm really hot on.
So what do you think the government is going to do? Because isn't the easiest thing, the path of least resistance, simply to plant pines because they grow faster? Letting pines then turn to converting to native forest over many years sounds like a lot more effort, maybe more effort than this government's prepared to require of people.
Well, I suppose it depends what's growing on the land right now. It may be manuka kānuka, it may be gorse. And gorse is second only to pine in terms of sinking carbon. And so what this offers is for people with a lot of gorse and or manuka, kānuka, to actually look after those areas and fence them off and do pest control. And so that's an active sink that will turn into native forest, and they would get money for that.
How crucial are the rules that will be set up by the government? Because they could be the difference between the shape, I mean, the actual appearance of even the smell of our hill country, whether it smells of pines or natives. Because if the government goes a certain way, it will encourage more pines, won't it?
Yeah, it would do, but already the Minister of Forestry, Stuart Nash, has ruled out pines. And so there is a tension there, and it will be interesting to see what they come out with. The bets are off as to where it's going to go. But what we've seen today is a multi-party commitment to dealing with climate change. And it's nothing that we can run away from. We've just got to face it and do some hard stuff. But there's also going to be lots of benefits in this. So we'll just see how the dice is fall. It could be really, really, really good.
If the government goes along with it in the direction you would like it to, which is to encourage, say, land to regenerate into native ecosystems, even existing pine plantations, if it's not economic, ready to mill them, then it's going to have to come with a budget that enables the stuff that we've also talked about, pest control, or even just the removal of pines in hard hill country area, killing some of them off so the natives can actually grow up.
For sure. And so that's what the carbon credit price, as it rises, will help fund.
But I think initially it's going to need something more than that, don't you think, Dean? Some more money from the government?
I think there will be money that comes through. The national policy statement is about to be announced on Indigenous biodiversity, and there will be different incentives there for private landowners to be able to claim things through looking after the native wilderness and encouraging, you know, a transition from gorse to natives within that. And so that's one of the kind of policy mechanisms that will help for that to happen. But that's all very dry stuff, and I usually try and avoid that in these conversations.
Sorry, Dean, if I'm taking you towards the dry stuff. It's my curiosity. But, Dean, I cannot have you on the phone without asking you a little bit about what's going on in your local forest, which is a sign of the season, the autumn, the lengthening nights, the cooler days. What's going on around you that's a telltale of autumn?
Oh, it's really interesting. I was in there today having a good look around. This is a season where there hasn't been much in the way of kahikatea fruit this season, but it's a heavy mast year for rimu throughout the country, and that means the kākāpō will be breeding furiously and successfully. At the moment, the birds are quieting down, winding down for winter. They've been feeding up in autumn on all the fruit. There is the rats and mice are quite active, as people may have noticed, making their ways into their home. My cousin Carol, she's petrified. She has a single mouse in her house, and she's about to call the armed defenders squad by the sound of it. She's compared to a little mouse, she's a giant. But in the forest, the rats and mice are running around now trying to find food stores. And so this is the time where they can be some of the most dangerous to birds because they are looking to eat. Of course, there's also lizards in the forest, geckos and skinks. And when the temperature drops, they can't move very fast. Their blood kind of goes like concrete. And so that makes them very vulnerable to rats and mice eating them alive.
That doesn't sound very encouraging. It sounds like it's a bad time to be a native animal.
Yeah, but also a very good time to do rat and mice control in the forest.
That's the upside.
It is indeed.
Dean, it's been great having you on again. Thanks very much for your time this evening.
Marvellous. Great to talk to you.
Thanks, Dean. That's Dean Bajant-Mercer from Forest and Bird in Northland, our forest correspondent. Back with more Talk from the Trees in about 2.5 months from now.